Author and historian Joe Jackson joins us this morning to discuss his latest book, Atlantic Fever, Lindbergh, His Competitors, and the Race to Cross the Atlantic. The book looks at an aviation journey and delves into the lives of those who competed to be the first to fly nonstop over the Atlantic Ocean. Today marks the 85th anniversary of Charles Lindbergh's successful and historic flight in 1927. For 5 weeks, from April 14th to May 21st, 1927, the world held its breath while 14 aviators took to the air to capture the $25,000 prize offered to the first man to cross the Atlantic without stopping. Joe Jackson writes about this race, a milestone in American history. The story has never fully been told. Delving into the lives of the big-name competitors, Jackson brings an original perspective to the race to conquer the Atlantic, and it's a pleasure to welcome Joe Jackson to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. I appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you.
What brought you to this particular topic? And assuming that when you're doing something like this, do you begin with Lindbergh?
No, not really. I usually start with an idea, and in this case it was around 2008, and that was the year of the presidential election and also the Beijing Summer Olympics, and everybody was talking about whether or not the United States was the most competitive culture on the earth. And I grew kind of fascinated by that, so I started thinking about the biggest race in the 20th century. And then when I started researching the Ortig Prize, this transatlantic race, I really started to get interested in two things. The construction of celebrity. You can kind of see we're so celebrity-oriented, inundated today, but you can see the forms of it taking place back in 1927. And I also started to really want to do more about the losers. The losers haven't been written about all that much.
It is fascinating about this that of the 16 pilots that entered, six of them died. I want to get to that in a moment, but first let us talk about how the contest itself came to be. This $25,000 prize, New York hotel owner Raymond Ortig came up with this. How so and why?
Well, he was a French immigrant, and he came over to the United States, just a poor boy with a few francs sewed into his belt, and he became a waiter at a hotel called the Hotel Lafayette on Washington Square in Greenwich Village in New York. And within a decade, he and a partner owned the place. And during the First World War, that became the go-to place for French military men and flyers to stay when they came to the United States, and they would always talk about their exploits in the air. And he missed his homeland. And then after the war, he was nostalgic about that. And there was a dinner for America's top ace, Eddie Rickenbacker, and Rickenbacker said, you know, I look forward to I miss the camaraderie between my French brothers and the French and the American flyers, and I look forward to the day that the airplane will unite our two nations in peace, not war. And Ortig, who was already kind of a romantic that night, joined the club that was hosting the dinner, and he wrote a letter saying he would donate $25,000 for this prize. He didn't realize at the time that $25,000 was an eighth of his liquid capital, so that if he had had a financial emergency, he would have been in a lot of trouble.
When you look at the culture, if you will, of how itching were people to actually do this as far as crossing the Atlantic nonstop?
Well, there had been earlier attempts, and there was in 1919, right after the war, there was a contest that was sponsored by the London owner of two big newspapers to cross the Atlantic, but it wasn't such a huge distance. It was basically the space between Newfoundland and Ireland. And then there were some Navy attempts to cross the Atlantic with those flying boats, and there were four planes that started out, and one only barely made it later. But the idea that you could cross what was considered, you know, an impossible distance at that time, 3,600 miles nonstop, people dreamt of it, and it's, you know, I would say that it was kind of like at the time trying to get to the moon, but the technology was not available until like around 1924, 25, or 26.
When, as you said, one of the things that you wanted to write about were the many people who signed on for this. Mm-hmm. So give us a sense of this class of 1927, if you will, of mm-hmm. what it was about it. And because they come from, what was fascinating in the book of the backgrounds, they come from such disparate backgrounds.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the one that I found, well, there were many that I found very interesting. The one that I was really surprised about was the there were many naval officers who joined up, but there was this one fellow who was originally a Mormon cowboy who used to herd cattle out in Utah, and he would always carry engineering and mathematic books in his saddlebags and study those while he was around the campfire. And then he joined the Navy, and as many Navy men did after World War I, they became aviators. But then there was also a Brooklyn businessman who was loved by the Jewish community. He made it across. He was actually the first transatlantic passenger, and there was a big controversy because President Coolidge congratulated every flyer that made it across except for him. And there was a fella who was a ladies' man and a very hard drinker, but he was known at the time as probably the best professional pilot in the United States. So I mean, they truly were a divergent crew.
When it actually came time for them to take to the air, and this really is, I mean, you talk in the book about how this all goes back a number of years to even 1919 with the establishment of the prize itself. But those 5 weeks, April 14th to May 21st, 1927, this is when it is just a fascinating time, and the world was just glued to this, weren't they?
Oh yes, very much. And they were glued to it. They were glued to it more than the 1919 attempt, just because the media technology was so available. I mean, by 1927, there were two national radio networks, CBS and NBC, I think it is, and magazines were spinning out words more, you know, with more mass production than they ever had, as well as newspapers, and you know, every film had every film at a cinema had a newsreel, a Pathé newsreel, and so you were just inundated with it, and people kind of chose their favorite aviator, and there was a lot of betting on this too. You can find in, buried within the stories of the New York Times, you can find occasional little stories about what the bookies were laying down for the various aviators.
When you look at Lindbergh, of course, being the guy, what was it about him, about the way he flew, that brought him to success where so many others failed?
Well, I think he outlasted all the others to begin with. He flew alone, although he had wanted a plane in the beginning, which was a double-seater, so there's a very good chance he would have flown with a co-pilot if he had gotten that plane. And if he'd gotten the plane that he wanted, then he would have been on the East Coast, and chances are he would have absorbed more of his rivals' philosophies of flying. But he was on the West Coast. He believed that the best plane for the transatlantic crossing would basically just be a pilot, a wing, and a load of gasoline, and he cut back everything that that would weigh down the plane. And so by the time the Spirit of St. Louis was actually built, he was so far along that he could not and would not change his mind. Now, there were several other pilots that had started out before him, and all of them were just as good as Lindbergh was, but they had crashed or they'd gotten into some sort of legal litigation. And so when Lindbergh showed up in early May, he was in a position that he could start very quickly, and after a week of bad weather, he jumped on the chance. He jumped faster on the chance than the others did.
And is it safe to say that if somebody else were to have become victorious, that they would have the infamy, the iconic name that Lindbergh has?
I think so. I think that take for instance Noel Davis, the Mormon cowboy that we talked about earlier. Early on, he was going to fly over to France with his wife, who was a kind of a Southern belle from Pensacola, Florida. And so, you know, after Lindbergh got married, there was a lot of press about, when he got married to Anne Morrow, there was a lot of press about how they were the first couple of the air. Well, I mean, Noel Davis and his wife would have been the first couple of the air. They would have been just as romantic and just as glamorous. I think the idea that he was a cowboy would have sparked everyone's imagination just as much. Richard Byrd had just come off of his claim that he had been the first to fly over the North Pole. Okay, so if he had won, he would have been presented as a kind of American Superman or American, you know, superhero. He had two big first to his name. There was a guy by the name of Clarence Chamberlain who, during the run-up to the flight, there was during a test, two little girls went aboard the plane, and the undercarriage, the wheels broke out, and Chamberlain had to do this amazing landing where he saved the lives of the two girls. I mean, can you imagine what kind of press he would have gotten if he'd been the first across? Mm. I mean, yeah, all of them had something there that would have made them huge.
Well, it's a fascinating story. It's Atlantic Fever, Lindbergh, His Competitors in the Race to Cross the Atlantic. The book is published by FSG. Joe Jackson, thank you very much for joining us on this anniversary. I appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. Again, Atlantic Fever is the name of the book. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.